From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. It's day two in the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. House impeachment manager Jamie Raskin kicked things off by laying out the case against him.
Trump incited the January 6th attack, and when his mob overran and occupied the Senate and attacked the House and assaulted law enforcement, he watched it on TV like a reality show. He reveled in it, and he did nothing to help us as commander-in-chief. Instead, he served as the inciter-in-chief.
We're joined now by NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell for the latest. And Kelsey, we heard from Representative Raskin there. He pointed to Trump's comments and tweets. What else did he and the rest of the prosecution say?
I think it's really interesting that Raskin actually told parents and teachers who are watching today that they should watch with children, because this is going to be a day full of videos that may be graphic and language that may be graphic. We saw, that this isn't an argument from Democrats where they're trying to tie the actions of the rioters and the comments of the president directly together and build a case that President Trump is not just a person on the street expressing political speech, as his attorneys have said, but that he is a person in power who is inciting violence, and that that speech is not protected by the Constitution. Lead manager Raskin said that if you're president of the United States, you choose a side with your oath of office, and if you break it, then impeachment is the main form of recourse.
Democrats also laid out an emotional case yesterday. They played a graphic video of the January 6th insurrection, interspersing Trump's speech with the actions of the rioters, breaching the Capitol barricades, assaulting police, battering down congressional doors. How did senators react to this video? Did it really change the tone of the proceedings?
It was an extremely emotional video, and it was something that, some senators said they found difficult to watch. This is a moment that we're going to see repeated over and over, is that Democrats don't want this to be an argument just about the process and about whether or not Republicans view this as a constitutional trial. They want this to be about those reactions, about the way that Trump spoke and the way the rioters behaved. And they really want, like I said, to be connecting the dots there. Now, Republicans said it was very moving, but it didn't really sway anybody except for one person in terms of voting about the constitutionality of this trial. So we still have a majority of Republicans who believe that the foundation of having a trial at all, of trying a president who's no longer in office, they say that is unconstitutional. And that is the basis on which they are entering all of the arguments we're going to see for the next several days.
But as you said, six Republicans did join Democrats to vote that the trial could move forward yesterday, including Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, who hadn't supported the trial before. Do you know, or has he said anything about why he changed his mind?
Yeah, Cassidy put out a statement after his vote and said that simply the Democrats made a better argument, that he thought that they were convincing that this was a constitutional trial, and he didn't feel that the president's lawyers made as good of a case, arguing their side that it was unconstitutional. He did caution, though, in that statement that his vote on the constitutionality of the impeachment does not speak to how he will vote on conviction. So he left open the possibility that this may be a constitutional trial, but he may not in the end feel that it rises to a moment of convicting on impeachment.
I mean, he's not the only one. There's been a lot of criticism of Trump's defense team. Republicans have openly panned a rambling speech by the defense lawyer. Trump himself is reportedly unhappy with him. How are they going to regroup?
Well, they do have 2 days to regroup. They have 2 days to kind of rethink their strategy. We did hear them say, we heard Castor say in his presentation yesterday, that they were already rethinking things after seeing the video that Democrats put together. So they have 2 days now where Democrats will have the stage entirely to themselves, where they will be able to set up these videos, where they will have that moment of going into people's living rooms on live television and reminding them and the senators in the room who are hearing these arguments of the day. And then there will be a break. There will be an overnight, and then they will be able to argue fresh. So that's something that Republicans are expected to use to their advantage.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Let's go now to California's Bay Area, where a string of assaults against senior citizens has alarmed people in Oakland's Chinatown. On Monday, police announced they'd arrested a man who is now facing multiple charges. Video of one attack shows a 91-year-old man being violently pushed to the ground. A local prosecutor is investigating whether the assaults were racially motivated. Hate crimes against Asian Americans have risen sharply during the coronavirus pandemic. The Stop Asian American and Pacific Islander Hate organization recorded 126 incidents involving elderly victims between March and December. The recent violence in Oakland's Chinatown follows several thefts in the neighborhood. Some business leaders are asking Oakland police for assistance and for citizen patrols. For more, we're joined by Julie Chang from member station KQED in San Francisco. And Julie, the suspect now in custody is accused of assaulting multiple people in a single day. What do we know about him?
Well, we know that the Oakland Police Department arrested and charged the man involved in the incidents earlier this week. He was charged with assault, elder abuse, and among other things. What we don't know is the motive. So the motive hasn't been released yet.
And there have been other attacks, right, on elderly residents in the Bay Area. There was an 84-year-old Thai man killed just a couple of weeks ago. What do we know about this pattern of other assaults?
The commonality between all of the violent attacks seems to be that they're seemingly unprovoked. We're not sure why these attacks are happening, but we do know that they're happening at a time when anti-Asian sentiments are high, you know, ever since the start of the pandemic. The other commonality is that a lot of these attacks are getting captured on camera. You know, there was one person I spoke with in Oakland. I asked him why he thinks these two incidents have gotten such national attention. He said it reminded him of the George Floyd video. Now, of course, we don't want to conflate the two or three videos. You know, in the George Floyd video, we see a man getting killed by police, by officers who are supposed to protect him. I think the commonality, though, is that the attacks on elderly Asians is something that the Asian American community has known about for a long time. Just like the Black community has said time and again that members of their community are targeted by police. So people have to pay attention to them.
Yeah, the video component does seem significant, but there's something that really seems to grip the public when you see it with your own eyes. And Julie, in addition to the violent attacks, we've also seen some thefts. We've heard Carl Chan, who is president of the Oakland Chinatown Chamber of Commerce, calling for an increased police presence in the neighborhood. What are you hearing from the community? I mean, is that in general what folks want? They want more police in the neighborhood?
So we're seeing a division between two groups. The first group wants to see more police presence, and then the second group does not. This divide also seems to be generational. You know, the older Asian American generations are like, yes, we need more police to deter crime. But then we have like the younger generations who are arguing for community investment to disrupt criminal behavior. They want more restorative justice. Also, what's interesting about this conversation, too, is that the group that doesn't want more police is essentially accusing the other group that does of seeing the Asian American community as a monolith. So it's like one Asian group telling the other Asian group, yo, we're not all the same. And so more police doesn't necessarily equal to more safety for those particular individuals.
And for folks who feel that way, we've seen some saying an alternative would be a form of citizen patrol or a neighborhood watch to start circulating in the streets. What's driving that? Is it mistrust of the police or just a feeling that law enforcement is too slow?
You know, it's the latter. So I spoke to several people in Chinatown who've complained that, you know, OPD or the Oakland Police Department is right by Chinatown. But anytime that they call in a robbery or an attack, police come hours later. You know, there's also been a lot of conversations about Chinatown feeling forgotten. And that's why we have a lot of these patrol groups, the volunteer patrol groups forming. But then there's also been discussions about whether or not these volunteer patrol groups are a good idea. You know, there's going to be a few groups that ultimately, because of systemic racism, because of just the way, you know, people are set up, they're going to be profiling Black people, brown people for crimes that they didn't commit.
And we have seen law enforcement become a contentious issue among city officials as well, right? We've seen finger pointing between Mayor Libby Schaaf and some city council members over a proposal to cut $25 million from the Oakland police budget. How is that playing out?
You know, the people I spoke with in Oakland told me that police presence had decreased in Chinatown long before discussions of defund OPD even started. And then when I spoke with Carl Chan, he had told me that he just doesn't want to see politics getting involved. He just wants to look for solutions and ways to move forward so that we can help the Chinatown community instead of politicians throwing blame at each other.
That's Julie Chang from member station KQED in San Francisco. Julie, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We are now into the second day of former President Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate, and it's widely expected that Trump will be acquitted because most Republicans will likely vote to acquit. Our next guest says that's because those opposed to institutions have a strong grip on the GOP. And if that continues, it could have dire consequences for our democracy. Professor William Howell is a political scientist at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy and co-author of Presidents, Populism, and the Crisis of Democracy. Professor Howell, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
As you watch the impeachment trial, what are you listening for in their language, how they justify their votes, and what this really tells us about the Republican Party?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now is a kind of widespread act of faith by the Republican Party to continue to stand by Trump. We've seen, nobody expects the conviction to get, the votes for conviction to get up to the requisite 67. And while much was said about the 10 Republicans in the House who voted with all of the Democrats to impeach, less was said about the fact that over 190 Republicans voted against impeachment, that this very much remains a party that's willing to stick with Trump and with the kind of populist claims and postures that he assumed.
I mentioned your argument about the anti-institutional hold on the Republican Party. Your argument is that this leaves only one major party, the Democrats, thinking critically about sustaining well-functioning institutions or creating or reforming new ones. What are the ramifications of this for our country?
The ramifications are really dire. Our democracy is on its heels. The levels of faith in our institutions are low. We've seen an administrative state that's hollowed out. There's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done in order to rebuild and reconstitute our democratic institutions. And as long as we have a major party in the throes of populism and right-wing populism, then the other remaining party that isn't always going to have the right answers, that is itself riven with cleavages of its own, doesn't have a partner with which to work, to set to work on these challenges.
I want to parse that out just a little bit.
Yeah,
I want to parse that out just a bit. The argument from Republicans on this is that they are very much purists. I mean, patriots even. And in the case of whether President Trump incited an insurrection, they're referencing and interpreting the Constitution directly. What do you say to that?
Well, I think there's both sides reference the institutions for their own, the Constitution for their own kind of political purposes in a variety of ways. A thing to note here is that populism, as scholars understand it, is a profoundly anti-democratic force in our politics. Because the language of populism is to say that everything is rigged, everything is broken, right? Everything is stolen. And that's the language that Trump assumed throughout his presidency. It justifies his emergence on the scene in 2015, 2016. But there isn't then a turn to constructive action. There isn't a turn to say, okay, things are broken, now let's try to fix them. Instead, the effort is to continue to sow outrage, sow disaffection, in order to undermine the independence and the operational functioning of our institutions. And in that sense, to the extent that those forces in our politics have taken hold of a major party, it becomes incredibly difficult to do the hard work of reimagining the institutions, breathing new life into our institutions that govern our public lives.
As you alluded to earlier, as you're saying that the Democratic Party doesn't have all the answers. What they're looking for is a partnership. Do you have any concerns that a wing of the Democratic Party could also go in another direction of becoming more populist or anti-institutionalist?
Well, I think we have examples of left-wing populism that we can point to in other countries, particularly in Latin America. There's a long history of left-wing populism. Given the coalitional makeup of the Democratic Party, it's less likely to take hold here, at least now, that there aren't anti-democratic, small-d democratic strains of the kind of coalitions of the Democratic Party in ways that sort of authoritarianism and grievance and anger and disaffection have taken hold of an important segment of the Republican Party. So I think it's less likely. But I'll say again, you know, the work of institution building is really hard work. And in a polarized era, when you have one party that's simply not particularly interested in undertaking that work in a good faith way, the chances of us doing, you know, undertaking the efforts needed to save our democracy are really undermined.
You know, President Trump was able to gather such a following because of his criticism of the government, parts of which he called the deep state. And a lot of Americans don't feel like the government is functioning well for them. I mean, you've sort of laid out a roadmap of what should be done. But what reforms do you think in the immediate need to happen?
So in our book that I wrote with Terry Moe, you know, we point to a reimagined presidency and really reconstituting the powers of the presidency with an eye towards building a more effective government, a government that actually can speak in a meaningful way to the anger and grievance and disaffection that, you know, many, many Americans feel. So what would that reimagined presidency look like? It has to do with decreasing the president's ability to politicize the administrative state, rethinking the president's involvement in the legislative arena by giving the president a certain measure of agenda-setting powers. There are a host of particular institutional reforms. We ought to get rid of the pardon. Mm-hmm. We lay these out in the book, but it really gets down to kind of reimagining the presidency and the role that the president kind of plays in our system of separated powers.
Professor William Howell is a political scientist at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. Thanks for this conversation.
It was great to talk to you.
And now to Myanmar, where tens of thousands of people are demonstrating across the country for a fifth day following a military takeover of the democratically elected government last week. Nyein Chan A is with the BBC's Burmese service and joins us now from Yangon. And Nyein, protests like this are not common in Myanmar, and yet large crowds are out in the street flying red balloons and wearing red, the color of Aung San Suu Kyi's party. Describe what the scene has been like in recent days.
More people are coming out on the street since last Saturday. First, the protests actually started on social media, but the regime cut off all the internet and also banned Facebook. And then after that, the people here have no options but to take the streets because there's a growing campaign called a civil disobedience campaign. They are like all the government staff to stop walking and to come out and join the protest. So far it works. All the major businesses, even the private one, they are allowing their staff to join the protest. And their main objective actually is to keep this movement alive in order to shut down the coup government. So the protesters also thinking about ways to avoid confrontations with the security forces. Just yesterday, we saw already that the police used some forces against demonstrators in Naypyidaw, the capital city, the administrative capital, and also in Mandalay, the second largest city of the country.
Well, just to fill in some details there, we've seen reports that there are pro-military counter-protesters as well. And to your point, police have been using water cannons and rubber bullets to disperse protesters. At least one woman was shot with live rounds during a protest in the capital. So are the protesters you're encountering worried that the military could escalate this crackdown?
Yes. Yesterday, a woman with a fatal headshot is now in critical condition. And then she has 5% to survive. So her family today make a press conference and then told media that she is now in her terminal stage. So demonstrators are more coming out onto the streets, but their technique is like demonstrations have been held in front of foreign embassy, including U.S. and also United Nations office, because it is safer for them. under the noses of international diplomats. But today we don't see any sign of forces from the security forces.
And so, Nguyen, then do we know anything about Aung San Suu Kyi's whereabouts or her condition? Because it's been a week now since the military seized power, claiming election fraud without evidence, and arrested the country's democratically elected leaders just as a new session of parliament was set to begin. So you're describing these scenes of protesters coming out in support of Aung San Suu Kyi. Do they have any new information about her?
We understand that she is trying to get the lawyer. And the lawyer himself actually didn't have a chance to meet her. But we understand that she is now under house arrest. Her party members close to her residence, they announced that she is in good health and then a good spirit. But we cannot hear any direct message from her.
So still some missing information and access there. Nguyen Chan A of the BBC's Burmese service is in Yangon, Myanmar. Nguyen, thanks so much for bringing us the latest.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
My name is Peter Sagal, and I'm here to interrupt your very serious NPR podcast to tell you about another NPR podcast, mainly mine, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Chances are that right now you're enjoying an earnest, serious treatment of some serious topic in the news or perhaps history or science. That's great, really. Well, that's not what we do, because people cannot live on serious alone. Listen now to the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me podcast from NPR.
The Biden administration is considering a mandate that requires all domestic air travelers to present a negative coronavirus test before boarding a flight. Here's Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg speaking to Axios on HBO.
Well, there's an active conversation with the CDC right now. What I can tell you is it's going to be guided by data, by science, by medicine, and by the input of the people who are actually going to have to carry this out.
And the White House is actually already getting to that input. Delta CEO Ed Bastian told CNN that this is a horrible idea and would take tests away from sick people.
Incidence of spread aboard any of our planes is absolutely minimal. In fact, very, very few documented cases globally, not just domestically.
Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan to talk more about this. And Seth, your reaction to Delta CEO, does he actually have a point here?
Well, he sort of tried to make two different points there, right? The one about, as you mentioned, taking tests away from sick people, and then what he says is minimal spread on airplanes. Taking that first point first, look, if the CDC ultimately says we should do this, then you have the health authorities presumably having taken into account the availability of tests and deciding that, you know, this is good for the public overall. And I'm not sure that Delta would be better positioned than the CDC to decide that. In terms of spread on airplanes, he's right that there have been very few documented cases. Keep in mind, Tanya, not every case, and in fact, many cases, you don't know where they came from, but sort of have two issues with travel. First, is it really spreading very much on airplanes? No strong evidence that it is. Second, just the movement of people around the world, which of course has helped spread the virus.
Well, if the Biden administration actually goes through with this, what will it mean for airlines in the broader travel industry from a logistical and financial standpoint?
Well, you have the direct cost of it. And I'm sure airlines would see this as essentially an unfunded mandate, right? They would say, okay, who's going to pay for this? And that very well might end up getting covered by an aid package. But beyond that, you have the impact on travel demand, right? Would this discourage people from traveling? And would it just make it more of a hassle to travel? So I'm sure when Delta CEO and others who feel that way talk about their concerns, that's part of what they're taking into account there. They would just basically feel, hey, life's already hard enough for us.
Something else, Delta is the only U.S. airline still blocking most middle seats on its flights. Do the other airlines really have no choice but to book middle seats, or have they found it doesn't actually matter much in terms of virus spread?
Well, economically, they've found that, look, the people who are traveling are probably the people who are least risk averse. And the people who would be most concerned about sitting in a middle seat or about sitting next to somebody who's in a middle seat without even that little bit of separation are likely the people who just aren't traveling anyway. So it's certainly a calculation, although the stance they take publicly is, look, the width of a middle seat, 18 inches, that's not 6 feet anyway. That's not true social distancing anyway. So they say it's basically a PR move. United, in fact, have said that directly and not something that actually prevents the spread of the virus.
Well, a lot to watch for and what the Biden administration will do with this consideration. That's Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
There's a lot happening in Georgia today. Prosecutors there have opened a criminal investigation into former President Trump's efforts to overturn the state's election results. And Republican lawmakers recently unveiled a number of bills that would make it harder to vote. These efforts come after record turnout in the state during the presidential election and Senate runoffs. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Stephen Fowler joins us now with the latest. And Stephen, let's start with this criminal investigation into attempts to influence the administration of the 2020 election. This specifically relates to the phone call former President Trump made to Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger on January 2nd. He urged him to overturn the election results, according to Raffensperger. What can you tell us about this investigation?
Right. So the letters from the Fulton County District Attorney's Office mention that there is an investigation that's been opened. It doesn't mention Trump by name, but does mention attempts to influence the administration of the 2020 election. Letters went to Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, Governor Brian Kemp, Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, and Attorney General Chris Carr. All of them have had different interactions with the president and the various false claims of election fraud. What we do know is that this is a criminal investigation into the activities surrounding the election, and it's not necessarily limited to the president, but expect that to be a big focus.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We'll be following that for sure. Then there is this Republican effort to change voting laws. Several lawmakers there have filed bills regarding voting access. Tell us more about those measures.
Well, it's really been everything from trying to get rid of no-excuse absentee voting to getting rid of secure drop boxes that allowed people to drop off their ballots without worrying about the Postal Service or the coronavirus pandemic to adding photo ID requirements to voting by mail. And the Republican lawmakers say this was necessary because the 2020 election was a disaster. But the Republican Secretary of State said, actually, that's not the case. And since Republicans control both chambers of the legislature, it's likely that we will see some of these things change, but it remains clear how much changes. For example, the Speaker of the House says he doesn't support getting rid of no-excuse absentee voting.
Secretary of State Raffensperger, who is a Republican, has assured people many times that the November election was one of the most secure and successful in recent history. There was no widespread fraud or irregularities. Is the Georgia Republican Party still trying to prove that there was?
Absolutely. There is a section of the party, including party leadership, that says that it was not safe, it wasn't secure, and there was fraud that robbed President Trump of victories, despite Republicans winning pretty much every other down ballot race.
That's Stephen Fowler, political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. We'll be following all of this with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, the rollout has been slower than most would like, but millions of Americans have been able to get at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. So now what? Public health officials say people who've been vaccinated should still take precautions, like wearing masks and social distancing, because vaccines aren't perfect, and it may be possible to pass the coronavirus to people who haven't had a shot yet. There are also concerns about more contagious variants spreading, and there's the idea that if you give people an inch, they'll take a mile. Our next guest argues those kinds of warning messages may be oversimplified and has been writing about how to have nuanced conversations on navigating life post-vaccine. Dr. Monica Gandhi is an infectious disease specialist at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Gandhi, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You wrote recently that to motivate people to get vaccinated, we need to message optimism, not doom. What do you mean by that?
You know, what I mean by that is that I've been looking at ads in Europe, and they show older people saying, I get vaccinated so I can see my grandchild, or I get vaccinated so I can gather with my friends. And we are sort of, in general, messaging a kind of non-nuanced, I get vaccinated so that nothing changes. That actually isn't true. Of course, things will change after vaccination. It will change in a tiered way, meaning vaccinated people may have a set of recommendations that will be differ from unvaccinated. If you put a vaccinated and unvaccinated person together, they'll be different. But these kind of tiered recommendations, the public can actually understand. We do it in HIV all the time. And it could motivate vaccination instead of saying, oh, nothing is going to change, which isn't accurate.
I see. But, you know, from a practical standpoint, you know, a lot of the first folks to get vaccinated are older Americans. So they're wondering things like, you know, can I hug my grandchildren again? Or am I going to be able to go to that wedding that has been planned for next summer? I mean, for folks who have these kinds of questions, what's your guidance?
My guidance is use the principles of, again, of this nuanced tiered messaging and think, okay, if you're vaccinated, you're actually the one who's safe. So the question of you hugging your grandchild is more around, is there a very low chance that you could transmit to a grandchild? I think it's very, very low. And every family is going to decide for themselves if they want that grandmother to mask before they hug their grandchild, or if they want them to test before they come and visit their grandchild. But older people gathering together who have been vaccinated is a perfectly safe activity. And when you said, give an inch, take a mile, I really want to comment on that, because our messaging, especially in the United States around this entire pandemic, has been one that has been a little distrustful of the public. I'm going to give you really simple instructions so you don't actually go outside of my instructions. So stay at home even is kind of an instruction that belies the need to work for essential workers or loneliness for single people. So instead, it's really okay to say, if this, then that. Vaccinated people together, fine. Vaccinated against unvaccinated, you decide how much the data on transmission concerns you. I personally am very, very convinced that by definition, reducing symptomatic illness is also going to reduce what's in your nose from all this accumulating data. But we can wait until that data is perfect. And then a family will decide for themselves if they want the grandmother to test before they hug the child.
And how about for the sort of general population? I mean, when do you think many of us will be able to, you know, gather with friends and family again and let your guard down?
It'll happen when we reach herd immunity. What does that mean? It means maybe 70% coverage. We already have maybe 50 to 100 million people in the U.S. have already been infected with COVID. We've had 32 million vaccinated as of February 7th by the CDC. I don't know how long it's going to take. The way the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are rolling out, it's very much slower than we had hoped. And I'm really hoping that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine will be added on February 26th by the FDA as yet another option so that we can get to herd immunity faster. When will it happen? Fall or winter of 2021, depending on rollout. And that's the entire point. It will be normal. We will gather.
So I have to ask then, Dr. Gandhi, have you yourself joined the herd yet? Have you gotten the shot? And if so, yes. Are you going about your life any differently than before you were vaccinated?
So I am a healthcare worker. I have gotten both doses of the vaccine, and I'm 14 days post my second dose, so I am truly immune. Yeah, 95% efficacy and 100% efficacy against severe disease with these two mRNA vaccines that we have in this country. My parents got their first dose yesterday. They are going to have their second dose in 4 weeks, and then 10 to 14 days after that, they will travel. It will be two vaccinated people visiting one another, so that feels really safe, and we will be visiting without restrictions. However, I am not changing my behavior outside the home because there are many people who are unvaccinated. I want to be respectful. We don't want a system where we don't know who's vaccinated, who's unvaccinated. And if there's this tiny chance I have that colonization, I'm not going to pass it. So I haven't changed anything outside the home. But there are many healthcare workers who are meeting and sitting down together without their masks.
It's so great, though, to hear that you'll be able to visit with your folks soon, unmasked, yes, and in a more normal state. I can see now why you're feeling optimistic, and I appreciate your sharing that little bit of sunshine with us as well.
Yes.
Dr. Monica Gandhi is an infectious disease specialist at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Gandhi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are you on Clubhouse? The audio-based social networking app is less than a year old, but it's become one of the most downloaded apps in the Apple Store. That could be thanks in part to a wave of celebrities and high-profile venture capitalists who have joined and promoted the platform, which lets users live stream audio and set up interactive chat rooms that function either as stand-ins for live in-person events or just places to have spontaneous conversations. Last week, Elon Musk dropped in on the Good Time Show, a late night show which is hosted on Clubhouse.
Elon, what can I say? Thank you so much. I hope you had a fun time for your first time on Clubhouse. Did you have fun?
Yeah, it's great. This is awesome. I didn't even know it existed a week ago, so it seems cool.
Well, NPR arts editor Nina Gregory was an early adopter of Clubhouse, and she's with us now to talk more about it. Hey, Nina.
Thank you.
Okay, so I laid out a little of how this app works. How would you describe it?
You know, I think for me, Tanya, it's become the third space in pandemic. You know, if the third space is not home or work for some people, it's a coffee house or it could be a bar, a park, a place to hang out with friends. And as the isolation of pandemic set in, this app came into my life right at a time where I really missed both the camaraderie of our newsroom and the casual encounters we get to have so often as journalists and just as people. And for me right now, that's kind of what Clubhouse has served as.
It's also become a place to figure out how to work through our new pandemic world, right?
Yeah. You know, last night I was in a room and a musician named Kristen Leanne, who is a viola player who also uses live feedback loops and all kinds of musical effects, who was almost doing like a sound check for a room so that we could tell her how a mix sounded. You know, and as somebody who works in audio, these are things I love to discuss. Let me give you a little sample of what it sounded like last night when she was playing. You know, and that's not the only music that I'm finding on Clubhouse is live performance, but there are a lot of people from the music industry on the app. Another thing there is something called Cotton Club, which is a weekly event where people can change their picture to a black and white image of their favorite jazz musician and come hang out and listen to DJs play music. And every night there's actually a room that a lot of people have started going into called the Lullaby Club, where a musician named Axel Mansour hosts others, and they play music to help people fall asleep too.
Nina, this all sounds so beautiful, but we've also had a lot of discussions lately about social media platforms and the problem of misinformation spreading. Extremist groups organizing online, for example. Has there been any discussion on Clubhouse about how this new platform is trying to avoid these kinds of problems?
That's a great question. And I would say something like 90% of all conversations on Clubhouse are about Clubhouse. And whether it's misinformation in rooms about vaccines or COVID, you'll have physicians who come in and run sort of Q&A rooms. And I'm talking like people, you know, from Harvard's medical school. However, there are rooms where people can say things that are false, that are misinformed, and they go unchallenged. But like being in a bar, if people say crazy offensive things, there are tools on the app to mute and boot, as they say, to quiet someone or to throw them out or to escalate it. But it is an ongoing problem and something that is going to continue to need careful attention.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Does this initial success say anything more about the future of audio-based apps out of Silicon Valley? I mean, The Verge actually reported this week that Mark Cuban is planning to launch his own podcast app that allows hosts to, quote, talk to fans live and monetize their conversations. I mean, that sounds a lot like Clubhouse.
It does. And people are learning, Tanya, what we and our listeners have known for a long time, which is audio is the best medium to communicate intimate personal stories, as well as to talk to one another and hear one another. I think it's great. I think more competitors will make this ultimately a better experience for the user, or I hope it will.
Yeah. I mean, you said earlier that it's kind of the third place for you between work and home. Do you think that it's going to stay popular once people are able to return en masse to live events and public gatherings and work?
You know, I think that's the $100 million question with Clubhouse. I think there are opportunities where people maybe won't be able to travel places. You know, I think internationally it can help people connect, share information, but I think the quality of that information or the entertainment value will be the ultimate reason people come. And if the content's not there, pandemic or not, they're not going to come. Mm-hmm.
That's NPR arts editor Nina Gregory talking to us about the app Clubhouse. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now.